Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Housing and its affordability in today's widening wealth gap in American society. There is a constellation of views about this. We offer three perspectives from an affordable housing activist, a major urban housing developer, and a builder of affordable housing in a smaller Kentucky community. We begin with our Future Tense series and host Chris Begley.
Well, today on Future Tense, I'm going to be talking with Drew Bowling. He's the assistant director of the Lexington Fair Housing Council, a nonprofit agency dedicated to the eradication of discrimination in housing. Drew's a social worker whose primary focus is coordinating discrimination tests, investigating allegations of fair housing violations, and an old friend of mine. Hi, Drew. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
One of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you today about housing is because some of these moratoriums on evictions are going to be up soon. And thinking about that, it got me wondering about all of the issues that came up during the pandemic. When I think about this, I think, well, eviction obviously is going to be a big one.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, what were some of the housing issues that became most concerning during the pandemic?
I think you're right. Eviction was it. And I think that is the result of a lack of affordable housing. That became very apparent how close people were living to the edge of being displaced involuntarily, losing their home, because things shut down in March. And then suddenly, it's pretty terrible if you miss one paycheck and suddenly you're maybe going to lose your home. And specifically for renters, I know with a mortgage, there's a couple of programs or things where you get a little bit more assistance or a little more help to make sure you don't lose your home. Those things don't happen for renters. It doesn't matter how long you've lived at a place. It doesn't matter how regularly you pay your rent. You miss a payment, and in Kentucky, for non-payment, you can literally go from having stable housing for years to 7 days from, losing home that you had for many years. So I think the affordable housing problem was certainly thrust into the headlines and the spotlight, because suddenly it was affecting not just low-income people, but people for whom housing hadn't even been as much of a precarious thing. Because I think it was starting to pull up and grab people who maybe were living a little more comfortably, because people were losing their income, and I don't think nobody expected to lose their income because of a pandemic last year. So I think it really devastated a lot of people, took a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, we hear a lot about younger generations sort of not buying housing. And things of that nature. And it seems to me that all that is wrapped up to some degree in affordable housing. Why is that so hard to do? What is the issue with creating what we would consider affordable housing?
Well, it's only affordable if it's based on what I can afford to pay, right? So shortly, it's because wages just haven't kept up with the inflation of housing. Now, housing, we can argue whether or not it should be as expensive as it is. And we can go in different directions that way. But, if we're going to hold that this is what housing costs, wages just haven't caught up. And I think I kind of get tickled a little bit when I see posts or headlines on the internet of people complaining that nobody wants to go back to work. I was like, well, they got a glimpse of what it was like when they were getting the unemployment benefits, and that what it looks like to have a closer to a living wage. You shouldn't have to work two jobs just to afford a $700 a month rent.
So maybe focusing on affordable housing is kind of missing the point. It might be more about the living wage.
Yeah, I think that's really what it is. Other towns have done some stuff to try to enforce affordable housing, such as having some kind, I forget what the technical term is, but basically if I build an apartment complex, there's some ordinance that says I have to dedicate 15% of those units to be fair market rent. When, that's fair market rent is basically what is calculated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, that this is how much your rent should be for a one bedroom apartment or a two bedroom apartment if we're going to assume you only spend 30% of your income on your housing costs. which is just a made-up number, right? It could be 30%, it could be 10%, it's whatever, but that's what they use. The fair market rent is, it's kind of a generalized term, but also it's, you know, segregation means that housing is worth different things in different places. So fair market rent, you might be able to find that in a neighborhood that's been actively divested in for the past 50 years, but you'll never find, you know, that's something as a fair market rent in like a more affluent neighborhood that's been segregated that way for a while. So even saying like you're going to dedicate a certain number of units to fair market rent doesn't actually make them affordable. And there's not really been a lot of traction in Kentucky anywhere I know of that that's gotten any momentum.
In some ways, it seems like that could exacerbate some of these other problems. And one of those other issues that we hear about, especially when you think about neighborhoods that have not seen any kind of investment in infrastructure or else or other things over the last decades, is gentrification. Right. This is something we talk about a lot in cities like Lexington. Is that a major contributor to any of these issues that are of concern?
I think so. Especially because it's this thing where like certain outside people see a community and think it's, you know, I think the tech term is to disrupt it, right? To change the status quo or whatever. And it's just like other people's livelihoods aren't yours to just disrupt because you've got money you want to play with. In the East End, for example, it's a neighborhood in Lexington that's been, you know, divested and segregated for a long time. It's now becoming pretty popular for people to buy houses there and rent them and flip them. And, you know, I knew a Black family that lived in there who had lived in the rental house for 18 years. It was the only house their teenage son had ever known. And the landlord just decides he's going to sell it to somebody who's going to flip the house and, you know, sold it for like $20,000. Somebody flipped it and then ultimately it sells for $250,000. Like, that's just outrageous, you know, and like that's what's happening because people are building houses or building homes for folks who live in the community can't afford. And, you know, there's this conflation between gentrification and redevelopment. Like, redevelopment's great. Investment in communities is great. It's unfortunate that like when they finally get like a grocery store or a couple of coffee shops, the people who've lived there so long can no longer afford to live there to enjoy those things that have finally arrived.
I wonder if some of the issues that have been exacerbated during the pandemic in terms of the inequalities that become more apparent are going to sort of accelerate some of these issues. You know, the economy potentially coming back is, of course, not going to be equitably and equally distributed.
Yeah, it isn't. And I worry about what it's going to do to, like, the rental market, because I think the direction it's going in, the worst case scenario, is, like, people don't even have rental properties anymore. Everything just becomes an Airbnb. And so then you just have a bunch of vacant, overpriced units in a neighborhood, and they're not being occupied, and they're controlled by people who don't live in the neighborhood. And that's like kind of my worst case apocalypse scenario. If we extend this out, is that everything is just, like I said, some kind of weird Disney movie themed Airbnb that nobody can actually live in. It's just a temporary rental.
One of the other things that I think about is the difference that you might see between urban and rural housing mm-hmm. issues. You know, a lot of about what we've talked about so far are urban concerns, perhaps. Is there a difference? And what are some of the important differences between urban and rural housing issues?
In some of the metro areas in Kentucky is basically, it's called the Uniform Residential Landlord-Tenant Act. And it is like the best effort that we have to kind of protect renters and give them rights. But those only really exist in mostly metro areas. Rural renters are extremely at risk for just the whims of the person they rent from. Leases aren't required, mandatory time notices, like a 30-day notice to move or a 7-day notice to because you haven't paid rent, those aren't required. A lot of habitability standards aren't usually applied. So rural people are really, they've really been left behind by Kentucky legislators. And as far as, you know, the protections for them. And I think you see this doubly as hard in mobile unit parks, I mean, there was this what happened in Moorhead with North Fork folks who had been living there, and then somebody, some developer from Lexington decided to buy it and turn it into a strip mall or a shopping strip, or whatever it was. People can own a mobile unit, but like, don't own the land underneath it. It doesn't matter if you own the home that is on the property, if you don't own the property that the home is on, as crazy as that sounds. And, you know, those happen a lot. And those are more common in rural areas where I'm from. And so rural people are much more vulnerable to all kinds of like housing shocks that can happen that, you know, still happen in the urban areas, but at least there is like some sorts of protection.
Well, as we're hopefully coming out of the pandemic, thanks to the vaccinations, I want to think a little bit about the future. And one of the things for me and many of the guests on this show is that the pandemic really made certain things evident that maybe mm-hmm. we hadn't thought about, or we had thought about but never seen it so glaringly. But when you think about the future, what would you like to see if we did it right? What would housing look like, or what would we do to, point ourselves in the right direction?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier about trends of younger generations, millennials and Gen Z people not really buying houses as much, maybe for cost. And I really would like to see the model of like individual or like single owner households start to become less common. I think there's a lot of potential in like community models, like a land trust, for example. Or even like cooperatively owned housing. Like if, you know, you and me want to go buy a duplex and we're just going to move our families in there, and that way we can afford it a lot more than if we were like just trying to pay for it on our own. I think a lot of like community-based solutions like that wouldn't surprise me if they start to become a little more popular. I mean, I know like things like mutual aid got real popular, during the pandemic, and they were necessary, but those have also been around for a long time too in Indigenous and, you know, Black communities. But, you know, popped up here in Lexington and popped up in Eastern Kentucky. So I think that model of just kind of individualism when it comes to housing, I really hope that starts to go away, because I think there's stronger protections when we have stronger communities. And I think that can be extended to housing.
Well, thinking then about a more realistic future where we don't do it all right and mm-hmm. we don't point ourselves in the right direction, what are some of the things that you fear might continue, or new things that might arise in terms of housing concerns?
I think the thing that I am a little concerned about is local landlords just getting out of the game. And, you know, the relationship with landlords and tenants is sometimes portrayed as antagonistic, and I don't think it needs to be that way. That was one of the things that disappointed me the most about the eviction stuff, is like, really, the landlords and the tenants have the same enemy. It's just like the banks that are holding the bills above them. But, you know, it wasn't like we shouldn't have been at each other. But I think more smaller landlords will probably get out of it. And as they sell their properties, what we have is just like a growth of corporate landlords, where it's going to be harder and harder to detect discrimination when they do this. And so I worry about that. We should know who we're renting from, not just, somebody who works out of a giant corporate building in Arizona. You know, that's not where I should go to find a place to rent in Breathitt County.
Yeah, well, hopefully we will point in the right direction as we come out of this. Well, Drew, thank you very much for talking with us. Today we were talking with Drew Bowling, Assistant Director of the Lexington Fair Housing Council. Thank you very much, Drew.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
The real estate market, I think the scientific term for the state it's in right now is haywire, with houses for sale in central Kentucky at a historic low, prices in double-digit growth. And there are multiple reasons for all of this. One who is intimately familiar with the home building and real estate picture is Dennis Anderson. For 30 years, he has developed housing across the region with a significant portfolio of rental properties, from the Park Plaza Tower next to the public library in downtown Lexington to houses and townhomes in the suburbs of Fayette, Woodford, and Scott counties. And so we've asked him to help us understand all of this. Dennis Anderson, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and your listeners.
And would you say haywire is a good word for what's going on?
For years, I've warned that this is where we're going to end up. And in my wildest imagination, I wouldn't dream it would be as bad as it is. We have like 2 weeks inventory on hand of houses for sale. In a balanced market, you'll have 110 days. This is a market where buyers and sellers both have equal pricing power. So it's truly a seller's market. We're in a situation where a family's housing cost is going to increase three times as fast as their household income. It's going to be a dramatic effect on housing affordability for our community.
People are getting way over the asking price. Are those inflated prices going to hold, or are we looking at a bubble here?
I don't believe we've got a bubble. There's some people who are going to pay too much, and they're going to have to hold their property for a while to get out. In a real frothy market like this, I had friends ask me if they should sell their houses. I said, only if you don't need to rebuy. And the people wanting to buy, I would almost sit on the sidelines for a little while, might consider renting.
Why is all this happening anyway?
Land, lumber, and labor. We have a limited supply of land by local zoning issues. We got lumber prices have gone up. Yesterday, lumber futures came down dramatically. You know, lumber prices have always been volatile, so that's nothing new for us to deal with. And then labor shortage. My company, we're looking to hire like 18 new positions. We've gone to a $15 hour minimum wage. We benefit package. It's in the 90th percentile of companies in this industry of equal size. Doing our best to attract great talent to come work with us.
What about other materials? I know there have been big supply chain problems out there. It's been quite clogged during the pandemic. Things like PVC, steel, are those issues in the pricing and the ability to build new homes?
Absolutely. It's leading to higher cost and longer build times. PVC has gone up threefold. Steel, we're getting to do some logistics and distribution fulfillment centers. And we're ordering steel for delivery a year from now. And we're redesigning how we build them to try to get around from having to use as much bar steel.
Well, you touched on this earlier, but is rental a decent alternative? Could it become long-term for many who might otherwise have bought a house right now?
We find two groups are renting, so that's a big part of our portfolio. About 60% of our business is rental housing. We have the 20 to 35-year-old who's growing their career, pursuing growing their income, and they need the flexibility to go where they can get the best job. So it meets them real well. And then we find people 55 and over who are willing to rent. They don't want to have the maintenance, the mowing. We call it no mowing, no maintenance, no mortgage. And it's just a hassle-free lifestyle they're looking for. They've had the big home, they've had the big yard, and they've had all the big responsibilities that go with that. And they're looking to a simpler lifestyle.
Well, what's going on with your business right now, Dennis? Are you expanding?
Yes, we're in a major growth phase. We've got like 1,300 rental units we're trying to build. We're trying to go from 450,000 square feet to 600,000 square feet of production a year. You know, it's only like 30%, but it's in a labor shortage, and we really need to recruit some great talent to come join us.
What kind of skills are you looking for?
We need a landscape architect. We need groundskeepers. We need the leasing staff. Most of our people who move into senior management and even the top management started here 20 years ago, and most of them started in leasing and have grown through the company. We've tried to promote from within. Very seldom will we go out to secure talent. We really like the people who have a history with the company and understand top to bottom.
Is it difficult to recruit people right now? We hear of labor shortages in all kinds of industries.
Yes, it is. We'll have people we're excited about. We'll extend an offer, and for some reason they won't accept the job. I don't know what their thoughts are. It seems like that may be turning. People may be interested in getting back to work.
Well, again, as you said, you're expanding inventory. What should that tell us about your view of the long term? Are these conditions here to stay, do you think?
Long term, there's a housing shortage, and we're trying the best to meet that demand. Long term, more people are going to be moving towards rentals than ownership, and that's where our major focus is, building mixed-use rental communities. And even the single-family homes is probably the hottest individual asset class there is right now. We see large companies moving to it, investing billions of dollars. We went into this in 2010. When we come out of the recession, or we were in the recession, recessions are 2007, and we figured it out about 2009. And we were in the business of selling lots to builders and realized that we had to get in the building business. And in order to keep everybody employed, we started building rental communities. The theory was if people aren't buying homes, they're going to be renting homes. And so we got on the front end of the big expansion of apartments and demand apartment. And now we're moving hard for townhomes and single family homes, logistics, fulfillment, distribution, where we think the major growth is headed.
All right. That's Lexington home builder Dennis Anderson. We thank you so much for joining us, Dennis.
Thank you, Tom.
The need for affordable, decent housing is acute nationwide, and that's especially true in Perry County, Kentucky, where 24% of the population lives in poverty. The Housing Development Alliance has been working to make housing available and affordable in Perry and surrounding counties, and recently began construction on a 15-home subdivision in Hazard. Scott McReynolds heads the Housing Development Alliance. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Scott.
It's great to be here, Tom.
And first, let's get a kind of a fix on the situation. Tell us, if you would, about the need for affordable housing in the area that you serve.
Well, the need is great in our service area, and for a combination of factors. First of all, we have, as you mentioned, a lot of folks who live on limited income. One of the statistics that I find pretty staggering is about 42% of our households live on less than $25,000 a year. And so if you're living on not a lot of money, it's hard to afford a house. And then even for folks who have a little bit of income, it's hard for them to sometimes find a quality house. About 35% of our housing stock are manufactured housing, and those are often in disrepair. And then, we've got a lot of coal camp houses. So finding a safe, affordable house to purchase is a real challenge.
Of course, we've been hearing a lot about soaring prices for materials, things like lumber, PVC pipe. And the housing market itself is crazy right now, with sellers routinely getting well above their asking price. And so I'm just wondering, how are those dynamics affecting what you do?
Yeah, we have for a very long time had a broken housing market. It'll cost more to build a house than it appraises for. And we never want to put somebody underwater in their house. So every time we build a house, we have to find subsidy, some kind of grant money, donation, volunteer labor, some way of writing the cost of that house down to what the appraised value is. And we used to think having to come up with $15,000 or $20,000 was a lot. And then, as you mentioned, the price of lumber has just absolutely skyrocketed. You know, we've seen our prices on materials go up 20, 30%, and then you think it's done, and then it goes up another 20 and 30%. And so that just adds pressure. We are beginning to see house values go up, which on the one hand is a good thing. But again, if you're trying to help somebody without a lot of income buy a house, having that price go up, even though it kind of helps the market, it actually makes the individual buyer have to struggle a little bit more. So we often have to subsidize not only the development, but then also find the people buying the house cannot necessarily afford to amortize the full amount of the sales price. And so we bring, again, some soft money, some kind of subsidy in below the appraisal to help them afford the house payment.
Well, tell us about Gurney's Band. First, if you would, his namesake, UK professor and the writer Gurney Norman. Why was it named for Professor Norman?
It turns out that Gurney Norman actually lived in the Islays area for a while as a young man. His grandfather, who's known as Uncle G, I always get confused and want to call him his uncle, but it's his grandfather who was called Uncle G, actually ran the Coal Camp store, the company store there in Islays. And Gurney talks about going to live with them for a number of years as a young child. So we heard that and we were looking for a name, and it seemed like an appropriate name. And I told Gurney when he was in town for the wall raising that kicked off the construction that, you know, sometimes we name something and then we figure out why later. And one of the things that I think is just so appropriate about calling it Gurney's Bend is, you know, so often this area is portrayed in negative ways. And what I love about Gurney's characters is he treats them with such honesty and dignity. And even when they're not perfect, you know, he treats them with that kind of dignity. And so I think, you know, it's kind of neat as we try to reclaim our narrative and talk about, I mean, this is the part of the country that helped fuel the Industrial Revolution, helped fuel the winning a couple of the wars and made America great. And so, you know, to reclaim that narrative as not all the bad stereotypes, but hardworking people trying to earn a living, it seems very appropriate to have named it after an author.
Well, you mentioned that Gurney's Bend is located in Islays, a neighborhood of Hazard that was once a coal camp. Is that correct?
That's true.
Seems to be some pretty interesting poetry there. The future being built on a foundation of the past. Does that make sense to you?
It does. In fact, Gurney alluded to that when he spoke at our little ceremony the other day. He said, you know, I'm watching Islays be reborn today. And it really does.
Is this a relatively large project for you and your team?
Yes, it's a 15-unit subdivision, and it's the biggest subdivision we've done. And to put that in context, in a typical year, we build 15 to 20 houses, so it's a full year of work for us. There's some economies of scale and some other factors. We hope to actually do more than 20 units this year, but it is our largest project, and it's exciting to see it finally come to fruition.
When do you expect to be finished, and do you have contracts on any of the homes?
We actually have about 12 of the 15 pre-sold.
Oh.
We hope to have the first homeowner move in August. If things go well, we'll have all the houses under construction by the end of the year, and hopefully everything kind of signed, sealed, and delivered by late spring, early summer next year.
Well, Scott, how do you make the connection between affordable housing and Eastern Kentucky's economic future?
Well, you know, if you think about one of the leading economic factors, I mean, if you always hear their talk about housing starts and new home sales, it's an economic driver. We know we have to rebuild an economy, and I think construction accounts for about 15% of the GDP. And, you know, if we're trying to rebuild an economy and we don't have a functioning housing market, that's just another challenge we have to overcome. So I think the importance of building a functioning housing market, it's good for the economy. It obviously is really good for the individual family that gets to move into the house. We know from studies that when people have safe and affordable housing, that they do better in school, they have better health outcomes, they perform better at work, less absenteeism. There's all kinds of benefits. It's a way for the family to build wealth, but it's also really good for the community. I mean, those 15 houses, that's 15 people who are going to be paying property tax. It's 15 customers for the local utility companies. We build really energy efficient houses, and so those 15 families are going to be saving a lot of money on their electric bill. So that's more money they can spend locally. So it's an essential piece of the economy, and I think it's one of the keys to rebuilding the Eastern Kentucky economy.
That's Scott McReynolds, Executive Director of the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard. That's really good and really important work you're doing there, Scott.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
Thank you, Scott. We appreciate it. Coming up after the break, the history of racial violence in Kentucky, as much a part of the present as of the past.
The past can't be, you know, separated. It can't be severed from the present. It has a very important impact on the things that we discuss today, the things that we talk about today.
And?
Grow your own is a hot term right now.
And no, it's not what you're thinking. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Under Main Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. The Kentucky Shakespeare Festival is now up and running in Louisville Central Park. This year's season includes productions of two of the Bard's most famous plays, Henry V and Midsummer Night's Dream, as well as an adaptation for theater of the screenplay for the film Shakespeare in Love. The festival concludes in August with performances by the Louisville Ballet premiering Shakespeare in Dance. Performances are free, dogs are allowed, and food and drinks are available. For more information, go to kyshakespeare.com. You can find in-depth writing about Kentucky arts online at undermain.art. Subscription to Undermain's newsletter can be found on the website. This has been the Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
What if you were to discover that some of the most familiar landmarks in your community, seemingly unremarkable structures, objects, or places that you pass by day, have for others very dark, disturbing histories? That realization has energized Micah Lynn, a self-described history nerd, returning in the fall as a sophomore to Kentucky State University in Frankfort. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Micah.
Thank you.
And let's begin this conversation with a very solemn event in Midway that occurred back in mid-March. You helped organize that. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, and in March this year, we held an event in Midway to memorialize the centennial of the lynching of Richard James, who was killed in Versailles by a mob of around 50 men who abducted him from jail, took him on a procession of cars to around the area of what is today the intersection of Midway Road and US 60, so US 60 and US 62, and lynched him there. This came as a result of an allegation that he had killed two guards in a robbery at the distillery in Midway. And he alleged that the supervisor at the distillery, was in on it and wanted to split the gains from the robbery with him. During the trial, the jury was split on the question of the death penalty, with one single person in the end hanging on and refusing to sentence him to the death penalty because he claimed that his Christian convictions, he had a religious duty not to sentence him to death. And after this happened, after this man did that and resulted in a hung jury, he was taken by the mob that came in on a procession of cars on Main Street in Versailles. They took the keys from the jailer. They knocked Richard James out with a blackjack and carried him away. During the course of the lynching, James was struggling so much. Mr. James was struggling so much that there were teeth marks on the rope that was used to lynch him. And this happened only 100 years ago within the lifetimes of my great-grandparents, and in a place that I had passed basically every day that I didn't recognize before as any place special. And because I had not known of this until just recently, I thought that this community needed to heal from it, needed to learn about it. And that's why in Midway we gathered around his gravestone.
Well, Micah, I know that you have a particular passion for pursuing this kind of history. Why? What drives you?
Well, the important thing is to know that my passion comes from how the past influences the present. The past can't be, you know, separated. It can't be severed from the present. It has a very important impact on the things that we discuss today, the things that we talk about today. Some studies have shown just how important our racial history, our history of racial violence specifically, has on our present. There's one really chilling study that shows that Black people who live in communities with more lynchings today are less likely to turn out to vote. That there's no influence on the voting behavior of white people or other minorities in these same areas. But where there have been more historical lynchings, Black people are less likely to vote. And there's just so much evidence of the way that the trauma of this violence, of really, it was a reign of terror that lasted several decades throughout the country and throughout the South. And this has affected us today. This is still a legacy that's with us. And that's why it's so important to me.
What other locations around Central Kentucky have you identified as places that we take for granted but do have these dark histories?
Well, one place that's important to me is Frankfort. As a student at Kentucky State, I've spent a lot of time walking around Frankfort and studying the history of Frankfort. And one of the main driving factors, one of the main motivations that led me to look into this history was when I found out about what happened at Singing Bridge. Though what happened isn't really the right word, there were several happenings across several years. Multiple lynchings had taken place from that bridge, which I had used before as the location of my senior picture, because I'd never understood that place as a macabre place, but the Black community in Frankfort had known that for a long time. I've been told that many Black people in Frankfort have known that bridge as the Swinging Bridge because of the lynchings that took place from there. But to me, it was almost a romantic sort of place. You know, when you cross it, you can see the locks hanging on the bridge from all the couples that come up there. But the history of the bridge is really tragic. It was a place where these mobs, up to 200 people in one case, would watch this racial violence, and it would be used as terrorism. It was terrorism in order to strike fear into the hearts of the Black people in the community. The two lynchings happened in 1909 and 1894.
Micah, tell us about your work that I know you do with the Equal Justice Initiative. Tell us about that.
Well, in Versailles, we're trying to have a coalition of people put together in order to remember the occasions of Versailles, to remember the racial violence that took place here. And these projects would end up with a marker being placed in Versailles to remember these the two lynchings that took place here. We're also involved. We put together the centennial memorial on the day of the centennial, and we're hoping to put together some forums and other things in order to really focus on race relations and racial healing from all this violence in Versailles, and to make this a community thing and bring the community into it, and to go back and recognize what's happened, because this has had an impact on our community.
You know, this obviously is an extremely sensitive subject. Some people believe it's best that we know as much as possible about what has actually happened in the past, and others believe just as fervently that it's best to let sleeping dogs lie because trying to deal with such painful memories could cause even more difficulty. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, the sleeping dogs, they're not sleeping. That's the whole problem. They're still awake because these things, everything, it reverberates. It hasn't been silenced. It hasn't been calmed. And it won't be calmed until you actually reconcile with it. Because we know of the struggles in race relations that we have today. And we know that white supremacy and racism is still a problem in our country and in our region. But so many of us don't recognize the way that that history connects to what's going on today. We can't just ignore that because it's an important lesson in how we ended up today. And unless you go back and find those lessons in history, you're not going to solve them today.
And what do you say to those who resist updating or revising history? Is the record as we know it today in this moment always subject to change as new information, data, facts are uncovered going forward?
Well, the problem is perhaps that the facts were already out there, but they were covered up because our curriculum in school, the way that we're educated, and just the popular narratives that get passed around in our everyday lives about our history is untrue. We know the facts about all of these things, but they don't get taught, and particularly to people in a white, in our white community here, you just don't learn about these things, because I had never known about it, and I doubt that many people living in Versailles or in Frankfurt ever did. It's very frustrating to me to think about how these decades of racial terror played out, and it gets covered up not because the truth isn't out there, but because the way that we remember our history tends to romanticize it in a way that's simply not true. In the South particularly, I think one lesson I've learned growing up is that our history sort of gets passed down to us like an heirloom. And there's some value in that. There's some value in the way that we learn about our family histories, and we covet it so personally, and we valorize what happened in the past. But when you learn that way, the history gets distorted, and we aren't looking at it from an outside perspective. We aren't looking at it from the perspective of someone really investigating the history that has taken place. And that's important, because we're so caught up in the, I guess, personal implications of everything that we can't really come together and recognize the objective basis for everything and how everything played out and how it affects us today.
Well, it seems to me that going forward, we're going to learn more about these things thanks to the efforts of you and people like Tessa Hoggard, who we had on a recent Eastern Standard about her book detailing the lynching of George Carter in Paris in 1901. That's Kentucky State University sophomore and future historian Micah Lynn. Thank you so much, Micah.
Thank you for having me on.
You heard homebuilder Dennis Anderson earlier in the hour talking about his hunt for skilled workers. How about teaching? Cynthia Reeser, host of our series on public education in Kentucky, has talked about it with Rob Akers, a former teacher and principal. Rob just retired as associate commissioner of the Kentucky Department of Education, where he oversaw the Education Professional Standards Board. That's the state organization in charge of teacher certification. Cynthia takes it from there.
Mr. Akers, Kentucky needs good teachers, school administrators, and school counselors, but the number of people qualified to be teachers is declining, not just in Kentucky, but nationwide. In a new report released by the Kentucky Council on Post-Secondary Education earlier this year, noted that there's going to be a number of unfilled vacancies in schools that's going to grow over the coming years. Teacher certification requires at least a bachelor's degree. And in Kentucky, of course, we know that universities train the largest percentage of those teachers and administrators in their undergraduate and graduate degree program. But listeners may not realize that there's lots of other ways to become teachers in Kentucky. So could you tell us about some of the ways that EPSB can allow people to become certified teachers?
Yes, absolutely. And I really appreciate that question, because we find that there are a lot of folks who decided that they wanted to teach a little too late. They didn't know when they were 19 or 20 that they wanted to teach. And then they feel like, well, I've gotten too far into college. I can't afford to change majors again. And I would have loved to have taught, but just didn't think they could. So it's interesting. And as a principal, I wasn't aware of all of these routes either until I went to work for the state. And so there are actually 8 alternate routes established in statute that allow post-baccalaureate candidates to teach in our schools. There are routes that range from people who have had what is called exceptional work experience. Say, for example, you have someone who was a career journalist and decided that they want to teach high school English. They can complete a portfolio and an application and have it reviewed by the board and be granted license to teach just based on career experience. There are routes that allow folks who work in our colleges and universities or community colleges to transition from that work into K-12 work. We have routes for adjunct instructors from different fields who might have very unique work experience. At a former school where I worked, we started a pre-engineering program. We were able to hire a former engineer from NASA and IBM to come in and teach our pre-engineering classes. She was not a fully certified teacher, but we were able to utilize her experience under the adjunct route. And so that was really a great thing for us. In addition, we have routes for folks to be able to go back to school to seek their master's in an alternate pathway. But instead of having to just simply go back to school, they get to earn and learn. They gain a certificate along with a job offer, and then they conduct their coursework along the course of the years that they are teaching and gain that experience while they're learning at the same time. One route that I'm really excited about is a new one that's called Option 7, which is a summer institute, or if you will, a boot camp. And we're going to have, we think, two entities in Kentucky who are going to be able to recruit and train their own teachers in a summer program. We have one district that is looking to recruit and train their own teachers, and we have an education co-op who is looking to specialize in the training of teachers who serve as special needs students. So that is a very new approach to a training route in Kentucky, and it will mirror pretty closely what already exists for the Teach for America program, but with the goal of being able to retain the teachers much longer than the 1 to 2 years that they typically spend in TFA. There's an alternate route especially designed for veterans. And we have really invested some time. We have a former service member who works in our office in certification who has really made it her mission to recruit these veterans who are coming out with some exceptional experience to become teachers as well. So granted, there are different nuances to each of these pathways, but as you stated earlier, they all require that bachelor's degree for a minimum. But if you have a bachelor's degree and a will to teach, we can probably find a way to get you working with our kids.
I know another new phrase that we hear now in educator preparation is a grow your own program. So explain that concept and tell us what kind of grow your own programs are being implemented here in Kentucky.
Well, you're absolutely right. Grow your own is a hot term right now. I'll start with a statistic with you. Our KY Stats group in Kentucky through Workforce Cabinet found that 80% of our teachers in Kentucky teach at a school within 20 miles of where they went to high school. And so 80% of your teachers typically in your districts are from there. And so Grow Your Own is about trying to start earlier in a candidate's career to get them interested in teaching, get them familiar with your system, your district, and try to set up your own internal pipelines so that you're not scrambling and you can create a rich pool of candidates who are not only familiar with your district, but who want to make your district home. And so there are some different ways that we're going about supporting this. Probably the route or the method that is going to have, we think, the longest term impact is around what's called the teaching and learning pathway. In Kentucky, there are several career and tech pathways that people are probably familiar with, whether it is medical science or welding, culinary arts, those kind of typical career and tech pathways. Well, there is one also for teaching and learning. And that specific pathway is the only CTE pathway that rests in the office in which I work. And with that, it's a series of classes that learners enroll in high school. They go through 3 or 4 classes. And with that, they are exposed to learning about the learning communities, learning-centered classrooms, the professional educator, and then they get a culminating clinical experience where they get to go typically to another school and they get to work with kids. And so along that way, there are dual credit opportunities. And so it gets them involved early on with the teaching career so that hopefully if districts and schools go about it right, then they're extending that opportunity to bring them back. Where we've seen Grow Your Own work really well in some other states, you actually have districts that are making job offers to students upon graduation, contingent on successful completion of their college program. But each summer, they're bringing those candidates back to work, summer school or bridge programs, ways to get them engaged in the district, learning the ways of the district, familiar with working with students, gaining that valuable experience so that they're learner ready and they are able to develop those folks very well. We're also working with an outside group called the Urban Schools Human Capital Academy. That's a national work group who's funded through Carnegie right now around some Grow Your Own projects, one in Warren County, one in Lawrence County. That's a very much a collaborative work between the local education agency and the state agency and our consultants with them. So we're hoping that we can help develop some model programs, one with a larger, more diverse district, and then one with a small rural district who both have unique needs for recruiting and retaining teachers, to hopefully be able to scale out to the rest of the state to show here are what two strong school districts did. These are the processes that they put into place to identify teachers pre-service to be able to recruit them and then to keep them long term. One of the neatest things about Grow Your Own in Kentucky is in this teaching and learning pathway, the enrollment of the students in those pathways, in those classes, actually has a higher degree of diversity than is what the enrollment of the typical school setting is. So as we look to also try to diversify our teacher pipeline and to make it more representative of the students in which we serve, we've got to go to where the candidates are. And the best place to catch them is in high school before they get to college and they choose different routes and get so far down their path they don't feel like they can come back to it.
Well, that's exciting. And I think sometimes these courses are also a dual credit. So they're taking a high school course and they can get credit in their future teacher education program. Is that right?
That is absolutely right. And I think that the more we can help to support this collaboration between our colleges and universities and our high schools to develop these pipelines, the stronger those relationships will be, the better the programs, I think, will continue to improve. And I think the stronger the candidate you'll start to see as well.
Well, thank you, Mr. Akers. And I hope we get lots of good new educators in the classroom soon.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share just some of the great ways that the state offers to get teachers into the classroom. And would just encourage anyone interested in becoming a teacher, go visit us at GoTeachKY.com or at the Kentucky Department of Education website.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer. Wendy Barnett, our producer. Neil Kesterson, our producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.